Actor and writer Gina Moxley returns to her alma mater, the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork, in her new show, If I Fall, a restoration comedy. Recalling her time there as an art student in the 1970s, she takes aim at the art history on the curriculum back then, populated entirely by, guess what, male artists over the course of six centuries. Gina Moxley, I suppose best known to many of us for her shows including Dante Dan and The Patient Gloria, takes steps to remedy that in her new play, along with soprano Amy Niari and dance artists Emily Tendrup, Maria Nielsen-Waller and Kath Duggan. I Fall Down, a restoration comedy directed by John McElduff. It opens as part of the Cork Midsummer Festival in mid-June. But Gina is with me in studio this evening. Even in the title, you're having a bit of fun when you say it's a restoration comedy.
Yeah, we tried to restore some genitalia over the course of the play.
Let us get to the point straight away, yeah. She says in this interview.
Sure, look. It's always about sexual politics with me, really.
Well, let's go back to your time in Crawford, because this is a say I didn't know this aspect of your history, and I've known you for a while now. No, I didn't know this. Maybe I just wasn't listening when I was told it. So tell us about that. That was the starting point, I guess, in your life in the arts.
From 74 to 78, studied painting. Well, loosely called painting. I was making furry things that hung on the wall. Like, it's funny going back into the art world for this show, just remembering and digging out stuff, slides and stuff of what I had. And it's like, oh, God, I'm banging the same drum all my life. Like, it was really about presentation of women, all of that kind of stuff, and going back and looking at this book, The Story of Art, that was originally published in 1950.
Which was one of the big textbooks when you were studying, was it?
Yeah, it was like the Bible, you know. 8 million copies of it sold, best-selling art book in the world. And over six centuries of male-focused art criticism and not one woman in the whole book. Mm. Like, 688 pages. He eventually squashed in one woman who got two paragraphs. The German artist Kathy Kollewitz. And
And does it come right up to it was written in the 1950s. That's as far as it goes, I guess. It doesn't come into contemporary times.
It was revised and it came up to about 1980.
Mm. Still no women. Still no women involved, not a single one. Although it does, and you quote this in the play, it does open with a rather promising sentence, I have to say.
Yeah, it's like there are no such thing. There is really no such thing as art. There are only artists. Only male artists. Yeah,
it doesn't put in only male artists. But as you read the 500 or 600 and whatever pages, you realise, oh, he means only male artists in the
midst
of all of this.
And the weird thing is, I don't know whether we even realised it initially. Mm. But there's a brilliant kind of corrective to that out recently. Another book called The Story of Art Without Men. This woman has done a brilliant thing. Right. Like, finally.
So, and maybe there should be a subtitle put on the other book then to make so that you get the two volumes to get the full effect, as it were. We had Christine Leach on the programme a while back, a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, talking about a major renovation in the Crawford that it's about to undergo. I think this is the last, is this one of the last big, last shows as such that will go on before that renovation?
It probably is. It's funny, I had envisaged this show in a theatre. And then I read about the big renovation and the Crawford and got on to Mary McCarthy and said, go on, like, take a punt on us. Yeah. And I knew Midsummer were interested. So I thought, like, it would just be great to go through the building, to have an audience move around in it, into the old lecture theatre, which will be no more. So that'll be levelled. That's going to be the atrium in the new place. So it's nice. Like, we're getting to kind of shake a few ghosts as we go through. And I think it'll be really interesting for the audience to kind of travel from the lecture theatre to the big main modern gallery. Then they go upstairs to what used to be my studio when I was a student. very nostalgic about that little room. And then we end up in the big sculpture cast gallery in the end.
That's where the end of the because to call it a play isn't quite right.
Yeah, it isn't. I don't know what you'd call it. It's immersive, it's participatory, it's got opera, it's got dance. It's a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. And you've touched on it there by saying it's got opera and it's got dance. Talk to me a little bit about Imani Ari, is the soprano who's part of the production as well.
She's stunning.
So tell us first of all, what that aspect of the production is.
Well, when I set out to think about it, I thought, you know, you don't get opportunities to do a big show very often. So I thought, well, I just don't want it to be a straight play with like yards of dialogue. It's not like being there, done that, but just a challenge. Mm. And John McElduff, who also directed The Patient Gloria, is back working with me for His Sins, the creator. And he's brilliant at those kind of events, I suppose, rather than plays. So I knew he'd have the nerve for it. And brilliant video and sound people as well. So I had met Amy through John before, and she's a stunning singer, but she's also really game. You know, she's fab. And then I thought, oh, I wanted a choreographer. And this woman, Emily Turndrop, she's married to Luke Murphy, the choreographer maker, and she's fab. She's just fantastic. Very broad skills. And so she came on board. She's worked an awful lot with Punch Drunk, so she's got a lot of experience in that kind of immersive work as well. Maria Nielsen-Waller, who's another fab dancer.
She's Swedish, isn't she, originally?
Yeah, and she's living here a long time. And Kath Duggan, who worked with Emily in Punch Drunk, who's fabulous. So, yeah, it's kind of very new territory and making it a bit on the hoof.
Yeah, so I suppose, because I read a script and I knew even as I read the script today, and there's some very funny lines in it, I have to say, some of which I can't repeat on air, but they are very funny, I have to say. But in the midst of it all, can I talk about what Amy Niari actually sings? Can I talk a bit about that?
Yeah.
Because it's a 12-page script. And quite
That's only the bit you got.
Oh, sorry. I thought maybe I got all of it. No. But even within that, there are, I think, maybe 3 or 4 pages handed over, quite rightly, just listing off the names of several artists who happen to be female. I mean, that tells us a lot about what you're, when you say it's a restoration, it tells us a lot about what you're doing.
Restoring women's place in art history. Restoring their bodies, restoring their names, their output. And I mean, it's not spoiling it because you kind of can't believe it when you hear Amy sing it. It's very moving, which I kind of didn't expect. But she sings these, there's over 100 names, into the ether so that this will go into the new building.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of gorgeous.
And that actually, when the way you put it there, into the ether of the new building, because I remember when Christine Leach was talking about that particular exhibition, there's one of the pieces there, I can't remember the specifics of it now, where some of the old dust has been gathered off the floor and has been made part of a current exhibition or a current exhibit there as well and will be part of it. So the old building becomes part of the art, in fact.
Yes.
And in this way, you send that those names out.
Kind of embeds it in the building, you know, and makes up for the lack, I suppose, you know, that still, like, women don't get half the amount of shows, they don't get half the amount of money. You know, I feel like, Jesus, here she goes again.
But well, funny, we're going to be touching on that, and we're talking about a tennis documentary, Gods of Tennis, later on, talking about how, you know, there was a time when they weren't even getting less than half the amount of money than their male counterparts, despite the fact they were playing the same game.
It's nuts. Like, it's just nuts. So Amy will sing this up throughout the building, you know, as we move from one space to the other. So it's going to be everywhere.
Yeah,
and so there's getting away from it.
It's literally bringing those women from not just Irish art history, but from world art history, and giving them a place within an art gallery. But it also struck me, I don't want to make a crass comparison here, but you know, during the pandemic, when the names of the people who died were called out, there was something incredibly
tender,
moving about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And similarly, you know, around the commemorations of 9/11, you often hear just those names called out one after the other. And it's incredibly
heartbreaking.
Yeah, just, and all you hear is a name. This is about, the name is such a powerful thing to call out.
It is extraordinarily strong. Yeah, and like her voice is, it just goes through you.
Mm.
I mean, in a positive way.
Of course,
and, like, it's very moving. I was just amazed by it. And the idea, I didn't know whether it would work or not, but to hear her, like, put it through the building is just fab.
Because I'm sure, you know, in a building like that, it will ring through into places that you're not expecting it to ring into. However, I noticed, so we've one singer, and you do say at one point along the script, you'd be glad to hear I'm handing the singing duties or something like that over to her. Are you handing all the dancing duties over to Emily Maria and Kath?
Pretty much.
Oh, so there's a little bit that you're not handing over.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Things change on a daily basis. I mean, they're very good. Like, you wouldn't want to be pulling them back. I'm doing my own bit with the writing. So, yeah, like, actually, Amy is a brilliant mover.
She can dance as well.
Oh, my God. There's nothing that girl can't do.
Well, this is a bit like when we were reviewing the Paul Mescal film last night, singing, dancing, acting. He's doing all, he's doing all of them.
Sick, these
young people who are very talented.
Jesus.
However, magically, it's not all in Cork. Do we go to Florence, or we certainly imaginatively have to head to Florence, and why so?
We do a sneaky kind of a thing. We're going to perform an art attack.
Right.
Which is really what Florence syndrome is sometimes called. This is a syndrome that affects people who, it's kind of a confluence of travel, high art and psychosis. So it's when people are overwhelmed by art and they experience psychotic episodes from the expectation of going to the city where it's seen. So in this case, we're talking about Florence syndrome, which the author Stendhal experienced and was kind of named after him. So that was my initial interest in for this play, but I've kind of diversified
you've gone
a little
in different
bit.
Directions,
but
yeah.
there is an element of the show that I don't want to give away, but that we as a group decide to go to Florence to perform an art attack. So we are in rehearsal for what we might do when we get to Florence.
Okay, and I understand you've been quite coy in what you're telling us about
very
that.
Very unlike me.
Yeah, because you want to hold some part of what actually that art attack is part of the surprise, part of the surprise of the show itself. But when you were describing it to me, Gina, when you were describing it as it's a thing, it struck me that if you had never gone near theatre, if you had pursued a life in the visual arts as you had started studying in fine art, this would be a kind of an installation.
Yeah,
that's what it would be.
It kind of is. Yeah. Oh, through the building. Like the only, when I was in the Crawford, I think it was my first month there, we had a visit from the conceptual artist, Joseph Boyes. Now, I couldn't understand half of what he was saying. But your education was bracketed by this book that didn't even mention women. And this guy who was saying, like, everyone's an artist. Like, there's nothing on walls or pedestals. You can make it out of anything. And you insert yourself into the work, which I'm doing. So, like, I learned more in an afternoon from him than probably 4 years in the college. And that element of performance was always interesting to me. And at the time in Cork, there was no kind of real theatre going on. So that's when I kind of moved to Dublin, got involved in writing and theatre.
Yeah, Enough Magic, of course, in the early days. And Restoration Comedy, of course, was a big part of a big part of those early days with Rough Magic, which is why there's a kind of an extra tickle in the title of the play itself. And happy to be working back in Cork. That must be nice.
Yes, sure. It is. It's great to have an excuse to go down. We're already looking to see where we go swimming and all that. And food, of course. Yeah. And the festival is fab.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll be able to, you know, get to see other stuff because we're on pretty early in the evening.
Right, we're hoping we might be part of the festival ourselves at some point along the way. So we might see you there at some point along the way. But in the meantime, Gina Moxey talking to us about her new play, I Fall Down, a restoration comedy at the Crawford Art Gallery. It's there from the 14th through until the 18th of June as part of Cork Midsummer Festival. And you can find out full details on corkmidsummer.com. The fine weather has been giving us all thoughts, at least for some, inevitably are turning to tennis, with Roland Garros nearing its second week and Wimbledon only around the corner. A brand new three-part documentary series, Gods of Tennis, starting this weekend on BBC Two at 9pm on Sunday, explores how an extraordinary generation of players in the 70s and 80s realised the sport from its genteel confines, turning the players themselves into trailblazers and global celebrities. Sinead Egan has been watching Gods of Tennis for us. She's with me in studio this evening. It's kind of about rivalries. That's kind of how they approach this in a kind of a way, Sinead.
It is. So it's set up in three parts and each focuses on two key figures, each of these episodes. The first looks at Billie Jean King and Arthur Ashe, who weren't rivals, obviously, but they were tremendous activists and agents of change for the sport of tennis and for society in general. Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe are in the second episode, and that is very much about their rivalry. Yeah. And the third episode is about Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. And it's, again, those two have a more traditional storytelling side to it.
The parts two and three are really the rivalries aspect. But part one, I have to say, I found the idea of this and the history of this really important. We touched on it with Gina Moxley earlier on, talking about, you know, the pay for women artists and the absence of women artists. Billie Jean King was fighting that battle back in the 1950s, I suppose 60s into the 70s.
Late 60s into the 70s. I mean, Billie Jean King is a monumentally important figure in tennis, but especially in women's tennis, because she is the person, the key player who decides, I want to get paid for playing tennis. And she becomes one of the first players to join the Virginia Slims tour, which ultimately becomes the WTA tour, which still exists today. So she is profiled in this episode, in episode one, as is Arthur Ashe. Now, both of these players won Wimbledon, and they kind of hook it on the idea that through winning Wimbledon and through having this notoriety, this sporting excellence, that that it gave them a platform to do other things.
And you have a statistic around
the number
of competitions she won and the amount of money she got in comparison.
There's a year in the 70s where Billie Jean King wins the ladies singles, the mixed doubles and the doubles. And she still wins less money than the man who won the men's singles that year. So this is her point. She wants it to be professional. She wants to be paid properly.
Has that changed enough? And was she really the one who started it all?
It has changed, but it's still not completely equal.
It's not equal. Yeah. But she started, at least.
Yeah. And in fact, just before, I mean, without giving it away, there is a little title card at the end of the series, which talks about, you know, what was achieved by the different players who featured. And one little, it leaves you with the last fact, which is that Wimbledon was the last Grand Slam to achieve equal pay. And that was as late as 2007.
2007. Mm-hmm. Arthur Ashe, I suppose, coming from a background that wasn't expected in terms of tennis playing.
No, indeed. And it's really interesting about him because it shows how he viewed himself and how he used his platform to fight against racism. For example, he went to South Africa and became the first black man to play in the South African Open in the 70s at the height of apartheid. And when he was there and taking part in that tournament, he insisted that black people be allowed to attend. And that was a really significant gesture because he wanted to be an inspiration for people there, and that made him very beloved.
So that episode one deals with the two of them, and I must say that social history to me is incredibly interesting.
It's incredibly interesting, and one thing that does come out is that Arthur Ashe wasn't terribly supportive of the women's side of things, and so they're in a sense they're trying to hint that they were pitted against each other, but that is actually kind of just they're really reaching.
That's a construct for the series, perhaps. There is no doubting the competition that is at stake in episode two.
So no social justice here. No. This is all about Borg and McEnroe. I mean, we've heard this story many, many times. It's still great to watch, but you know,
it's still great to watch, and it's still great to hear this clip. If there's only one thing you want to hear John McEnroe saying, let's listen to him saying it in the series Gods of Tennis.
It was the wrong side.
It was a bit of a spread, Mr. McEnroe.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line. Chalk flew up. It was clearly it. How can you possibly call that out? How many are you going to miss? Now he's walking over. Everyone knows it's in this whole stadium. And you call it out? Explain that to me, will you?
The linesman called a fault because the ball was on this side of the court.
The chalk came on, it doesn't matter.
No, the very fact that there is a spread of chalk, as you can see, Mr. McEnroe.
Tennis really does have to uphold authority in some shape or form.
Of course it does. When was that? So that's John McEnroe. And the great to hear the entire clip, not just the You Cannot Be Serious, which is
exactly it gives a context. So that was in 1981, and that was a first round match, which he won.
Yes, the stakes were relatively low.
Set the tone for that for that tournament.
And where was the McEnroe Bjorg time comp, whatever.
This was after the famous final in 1980, which was a five-setter. It famously had the longest tiebreak in history up to that point in the fourth set. They were tearing lumps off each other in the court, it's fair to say, but Borg came out on top in 1980. So this was building towards a rematch in 1981. Yeah. And tennis fans will know what happened.
And it's interesting. There's a lovely clip that you have, actually, of... what do you call it? What's his
John
name?
McEnroe
John
McEnroe's.
Yeah. John McEnroe's dad. Yeah. Now, here's a lesson in parenting for anybody who wants one. So your son's doing all of that, and of course you're going to be asked by interviewers questions about it.
Mr. McEnroe, have you ever sat down your son as a father and told him what you think, and asked him to behave?
3,000 times. He's not Bjorn Borg. He's
would
never
you like
going
him
to be.
To be as
no,
icy as
I wouldn't. Bob? I wouldn't like him to be that way because I believe that Bjorn is the way he is because of his own innate temperament, his own situation. John is entitled to be John McEnroe. He's not supposed to be Bjorn Borg, and he's not supposed to be Arthur Ashe. He's supposed to be John McEnroe, and if that on occasion is going to rile somebody or him or me, well, that's the way it is.
That's what you want your dad to say when you're in trouble.
He's in his corner.
Yeah, he certainly is in his corner. That's John McEnroe Sr. And there's a lot of that type of archive that perhaps we haven't seen, or in the case of the You Cannot Be Serious, that we don't see all of, we don't see the context.
Absolutely. I mean, they had great access to what Wimbledon holds, but also BBC archive. And, you know, that does bear watching again. But there are other aspects of the way the documentary series is constructed that just I felt were just a bit samey, just, you know, talking heads. And so forth.
Well, I suppose with the Borg Connors thing, or the Borg McEnroe thing, rather, I suppose part of the difficulty is it really is fire and ice, which is the oldest sports rivalry in the world, isn't it?
And you get people saying, you know, a hothead versus, you know, cool, calm and collected. We've heard this a thousand times. What does work, though, in the series is that they had great access to the principal characters that they're talking about. Obviously not Arthur Ashe, but they have really good interviews with Billie Jean King, with Bjorn Borg. Bjorn Borg is surprisingly giving in it, as is John McEnroe. And
I think let's have a listen to it, because there's a clip from Borg, and you think Borg is cool. He doesn't talk ice cool. He never talks about himself. He never talks about his private life.
For context with this one, this is him talking about his decision to retire in 1981 after he lost the US Open final against John McEnroe. And it's really touching because it shows how important the rivalry is to each of the people in it.
You're not supposed to do that, to step away when you're on the top. I didn't think about that. Why I left tennis, it was like our time was very difficult to have a private life. I said, I cannot handle this situation. I want to live this life.
Why didn't you tell John you were quitting?
I knew that I'm going to make him very disappointed because he didn't want me to step away from the game.
It hurt me personally. He was at a stage, I believe, where he needed to, you know, take a step back and then, you know, smell the roses a little bit more. And then you come back and hopefully you're fresher and ready to go for another 5 years, not never play again. So it was a damn shame is what it was.
I was relieved. I was happy to leave tennis.
Do you regret quitting at 26?
No, I don't regret, not at all. I'm proud of myself, what I did for the full tennis and what I did for myself. I mean, if I had more like a kind of a private life, I would have continued to play tennis, definitely. But no regrets. No regrets.
That's Bjorn Borg speaking after his retirement at the age of 26.
He was very young. He quit at the top. Yeah. Well,
but he wanted a private life.
He did. I mean, he was you know, properly rock, the first rock star tennis star. And it shows the Beatlemania that followed him around when he was at the height of his powers in the late 70s.
And interesting that which we see in other things. I'm thinking of Senna and Jonathan Hunt. John the Hunt, the other F1 driver, where when Senna had the terrible accident, Hunt wanted him back so that he had the competition. He needed him. They almost became buddies in the rivalry.
It's a symbiotic relationship. Yeah. I mean, what I was saying to you, when Federer retired, who was crying beside him? Was Nadal. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to episode 3 then of Gods of Tennis, the series that you're talking about. The big rivalry here is between two women.
It is. It's between Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova. This was my favourite episode of the three because, and not just because, I can really remember some of those matches, including the final in 1990, which is kind of the one that they set as the big building up to moment. So it focuses primarily on Navratilova here. It brings us back to her life in Czechoslovakia and having to make a really heartbreaking decision when she was a teenager, when, you know, the authorities in Czechoslovakia were inhibiting her career, and she had to make a call.
And that's the clip that we have.
This is the clip. This was in 1975 when she's in America to take part. They released her to go to the US Open, and she made a big decision.
Martina has been granted political asylum by the United States. I think her primary reasons for this, what she will tell you herself, is surely to enhance her tennis career.
I just felt that if I want to become number one, which I want to, that I couldn't do it under the circumstances at home.
Could you tell us what family you leave at home and how they feel about it or how you feel about it?
So my family, I have one sister and my parents are at home, and they didn't know that I was going to do this.
And that's Martina Navratilova there talking about her decision to defect, as it was called. You know, she looked for political asylum in 1975 in the United States of America, part of the Gods of Tennis series. So what do we get about the rivalry between her and Chrissy Evert?
I mean, it shows how these two women were portrayed in the media. You know, all-American Chris, hot-headed, athletic Martina, you know, really quite stereotypical. Mm. But it does show that they had a friendship, which in fact Martina kind of withdrew from because she felt that she needed to hate Chris Evert in order to beat her. And that was very interesting to see depicted, actually. But there's a beautiful moment, actually, in this story of Martina Navratilova when she loses the US Open final in 1981 to Tracy Austin, and she breaks down at the trophy ceremony, and the crowd cheer her. It was a huge moment of acceptance for her. She had just a few months previously been outed in the media as a lesbian, and I think that it was just a moment where she felt that she could be comfortable
in
herself.
She was accepted for being Martina Navratilova,
exactly,
as opposed to tennis player, defector, etc., etc.
And in the States, exactly.
I know you're a huge tennis fan. Do you need to be a tennis fan to watch this one?
I don't think so. And I think there is something there for the fans as well, in that there is a lot of archive that I hadn't seen before. However, you know, the plus side is that they got really good access with the principals here, you know, really, really serious people in tennis, Billie Jean King, Navratilova, Chris Evert. It's very traditionally constructed. It's talking heads. It's a documentary with a narrator, albeit a very good narrator in David Morrissey. But just feels as a format quite flat. And also Jonathan Ross, Miriam Margolyes, Claire Balding, I don't really care what they think about tennis. I'm interested in what the tennis players think about it.
All right, that's Sinead Egan speaking to us about Gods of Tennis. Starts on BBC Two this Sunday evening at 9 p.m. Now, difficult period for Foo Fighters of late with the deaths of their drummer Taylor Hawkins and more recently Dave Grohl's mother. Sense of loss pervades their 11th studio album since their formation in 1994. This new album is called But Here We Are. Next up, another band from that 1990s period. This time, former singer-songwriter and guitarist with Oasis, Noel Gallagher, with Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, let's just call them High Flying Birds from now on, coming as Pulp return to the stage and 90s rivals Blur gear up for another album release. Noel Gallagher continues to churn them out, I'm told to say, with his fourth release with High Flying Birds, this one entitled Council Skies. And finally, Sophie Ellis-Bextor, another artist whose career began in the 1990s. Seventh studio album is out today. It's called Hannah, with her collaborator Ed Harcourt. He describes it as kaleidoscopic joy. He may be a little biased, it has to be said. Our reviewers this evening, John Marr and Gemma Tipton, are here to talk about all three. We'll start with Foo Fighters, one of the biggest rock bands, without doubt, of the century so far. Current album called But Here We Are. And here is the opening track, Rescued. Under the lights, I'm just waiting to be rescued. Bring me back to life. Kings and queens and empires. That's the opening track, a little bit of it, Rescued, from Foo Fighters' new album. But Here We Are, Gemma Tipton and John Marr, as I said, our reviewers on this Friday evening. You know, if you were just listening to the lovely guitars there and the upbeat nature of that particular track, John, you'd think, all right, happy times. When you listen to the lyrics, you get a real idea of what's going on.
Absolutely. There is a real sense of pain on this album. This is a band that have suffered immensely. Drummer Taylor Hawkins died, as Dave Grohl points out in the opening lines there, just out of the blue.
Yeah, it came in a flash, it came out of the blue. Yeah. It came out of nowhere.
It came out of nowhere. He was just 50 years old, also apparently best friends with Dave Grohl as well. The beating heart, as so many drummers are, of Foo Fighters. And
interestingly enough, it is, Gemma, Dave Grohl, who plays drums.
Even though
they haven't taken on a new drummer, but he plays on this album.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a deliberate tribute. Mm. He said, and he'd written a book, and he said Taylor Hawkins is the guy he'd take a bullet for, which I don't think he'd say that lightly, even though he is meant to be the nicest man in rock and roll.
Yeah, but there is something, because, and he's also, I suppose, the most sincere man you think in rock and roll as well, because he has that quality about him. Then he also deals with the death of his mother. I know at his age that might be a little bit more acceptable and more expected.
I think, though, when sorrows come in legions, they layer up. And, I mean, you wouldn't wish what he's been through and his bandmates on anyone. But, oh my God, he's wrenched something out of it that is there for anyone who's had their heart broken or tramped on in some way. It's one of the most moving listens I've had for a long time.
And there's a song on this called, it's a 10-minute song, John, called The Teacher, his mother was a teacher. And she supported him through very difficult times and difficult decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a real tribute to her. And funnily enough, it's a family affair because Dave Grohl's daughter also appears on this album. She sings. But it is, 10 minutes is a long time for a rock song. Yeah. But there's a lot that's happening here.
It's kind of in two or three parts.
It's a suite, effectively.
Yeah.
And it is very moving, and it sustains itself over that time. And yet, despite there's huge melancholy, of course, and there's a lot of raw feelings, but yet there is this sense of defiance, this feeling that life has to go on. We celebrate those that we lose, and we pick ourselves back up. So that's certainly the case in the music, because it is still. Yeah. This is a band that have headlined Slain. And a lot of these songs will work in a huge setting like that. So they haven't dialed that down.
Yeah, and I suppose, wasn't the mother, she supported him through his decision to drop out of school. Well, maybe he dropped out of school and she supported them through that event, well, is a better way of putting it, Gemma.
I wasn't in their kitchen at the time, yeah. But she certainly didn't turn against them.
No.
And there is something I almost felt listening to Teacher a couple of times. It's almost like he decided that his mum and Taylor Hawkins deserved more than 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And there, as John says, there's extraordinary beauty in it as well.
The other song, you mentioned it there, Show Me How, which is where Dave Grohl's daughter is part of it. And if you want to grieve about the previous generations and his bandmate, then this is one where you just smile at the gorgeous kind of... Because it's a very philosophical song in many ways, the questions that it asks. And the music maybe here, more than on any other track, the melancholy matches music and lyric. Where are we now? Who'll show me how? I mean, a father and a daughter singing that's a lovely moment.
It is a beautiful song. And actually, strangely enough, at the beginning of it, it reminded me a bit of another singer we've lost, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden. Just that kind of the deep resonance. But there's a real beauty with his 17-year-old kid there. Yeah. And the two of them kind of, their voices meshing together really beautifully.
Stars from you on this one, John.
Do you know, there are a number of tracks that I loved, including that, but there were some that I skipped. So right. It's a 3 for me.
A 3 from you. And he manages to avoid, you were saying before we went into that, Gemma, he avoids being sentimental and schmaltzy.
He totally does. And it should be having your kids singing, I'll take care of everything and taking over from each other. Now, a wall of noise is going to help save it from saccharin.
Yeah.
And I'm giving it 5. And apparently I'm not meant to, because that's a game changer. But this is exquisitely beautiful.
Yeah. It's an exquisitely beautiful album, is how you're putting it. That's Foo Fighters, but Here We Are, the title of the album. Very philosophical, as are many of the songs on there as well. Let's move on to Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, band formed in 2010 with former Oasis singer-songwriter at its core. Council Skies is the current album. 4th in total, released today. And here is the title track. Heidi won't be fine behind the sun. Skies, the title of the song, and also of the latest album from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. John Maher, I said in my introduction to the overall album reviews tonight, another one that they're churning them out. Is that a bit harsh, or was I being a bit harsh?
You were, because it's been a few years since Noel bothered us with a new album.
That's a bit harsh.
It is a bit harsh, and yet... one might think I hate the album. In fact, I don't. I really like this. I didn't have particularly high expectations, especially for anybody who was subjected to his version of Love Will Tear Us Apart during the week, and his brother Liam tore him apart in a tweet afterwards.
In a surprise event.
It's been a long time since those lads had a good conversation together. It was a terrible rendition, it has to be said. I don't think Noel believed in it either. But this album actually works quite well. Works very well. And Okay, here's a little touch of Mancunian Noel. He says the album is going back to the beginning, daydreaming, looking up at the sky and wondering what life could be. I know that sounds highfalutin, but actually he does ask some big questions, and there are songs that look back to the past.
Did you get a sense of that kind of looking back, Gemma, that searching for, or maybe a little bit of regret in there? Maybe if I'd gone a different route, I'd still be talking to my brother.
Well, he did say they would reform if someone came with a plastic bag with 8 million in it.
fair enough.
Which he might need, because apparently he got fined 1,100 today for not disclosing who was driving his car. He also said, I think it must be great to be Noel Gallagher because you can say all sorts of contradictory things and get away with it because you are Noel Gallagher. He said he doesn't do nostalgia, and yet he's got track 5 is Trying to Find a World That's Been and Gone, and it's dripping with nostalgia.
Yeah, and it's not the only one that has that kind of feel to it as well. Dead to the World, maybe not nostalgia here, but there's a kind of a nihilism, perhaps, is what we're getting in Death of the World. Let's have a listen to a little bit of it and see what we think about it afterwards.
Till we meet again, and I'm dead to the world. I don't know where I've been, and if you say so, I'll be.
Lush strings in the middle of all of that, John Mayer. That's
Recorded in Abbey Road as well.
Sure, course, how could it not be nostalgic if you go there?
His Beatles fixation is here in many places.
Yeah,
as
there's
well.
More Beatles in that than there is perhaps anything else, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And not just this song, but several.
That's Dead to the World from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. Do we get much old Oasis raising its head? Do we get that in this, John?
I think in terms of the kind of the mass market sing-along, Easy Now really does that. You know, it is the kind of song that after a couple of listens you kind of go, okay, this feels like classic Noel. He's using his own limitations but doing them very well. And I found myself singing along to them, and I haven't to an old Gallagher song in quite some time, or to a Liam Gallagher song in quite some time. So that was a win.
Yeah, and Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, and he insists on having it as Noel Gallagher's to give it its full title. Has he succeeded maybe in a way with this particular offshoot, Gemma, that in a way people didn't expect perhaps?
I think all I can hear when I'm listening to anything by Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds is wishing that other half was back. And when I hear Liam Gallagher as well, they're both very strong, occasionally rising to genius in moments, but together they're better.
So £8 million in a plastic bag is what you're currently trying to find.
They'd probably easily make it back.
Yeah, for quite great. You could lend it to them. So does this album work overall for you then, from Noel Gallagher, Gemma, and Stars?
3 out of 5. It didn't seduce me so much that I didn't keep hearing other bands coming through it.
All right, 3 out of 5. John?
It did seduce me. I mean, this is the fourth album from this group, and I think it's by far the best. The previous ones lack consistency. There were some good songs, but I think on the whole this works well. So 4 out of 5 for me.
4 out of 5 from you. All right, that's Noel Gallagher's High Flying Bird and the album called Council Skies. Let's move on to our third and final album then, coming from Sophie Alice Baxter. November 2020, we spoke to her, in fact, here on the programme about her album Songs from a Kitchen Disco, which she released following a string of feel-good online YouTube videos filmed in her own kitchen. Became enormously popular in pandemic times, post-pandemic, and with equal glee, she brings us her new studio album. It's called Hannah, her 7th in total. Let's have a listen to a track called Beyond the Universe.
Feel the light hit the top as the sun is coming up. Through our skin it enters in right to the heart of us. We're not tethered to the ground, not weighed down by any sound. Thank you.
Sophie Ellis-Bextor there, and the song Beyond the Universe from her new album, Hannah. I kind of had meant to start with A Thousand Orchids on this one, Gemma, because it starts with a lovely electronic keyboard kind of arpeggios thing that go on. But then I realised, oh yeah, that's in Beyond the Universe as well, and I'm guessing probably in Lost in the Sunshine that I have up on the computer here in front of me as well. But she can sing.
She's got a very beautiful voice. It feels like she's going through the motions. It feels like time to get an album out and here we go. I was also wondering, when I can't forgive her, she's responsible for two of the biggest earworms, If This Ain't Love and Murder on the Dance Floor. And after, I mean, you've heard how much I loved the Foo Fighters, but it's Sophie Ellis-Bextor that's lodged in my head.
I despise.
And not in a good way. Okay. No, it's impossible to be too negative. It's sunshiny music. It's poppy. It's pleasant. It's lovely. But she's not ripping out any emotion in it.
I was kind of surprised when I came into the studio. I asked both of you, actually, when you came in at just after 7:30, I said, John, how many tracks are on the Sophie Ellis-Bextor? And I looked down at my own notes here and I thought, oh, I have 12 written down here. Is it not more?
Yeah, it does. It really drags. And I think in isolation, the songs are very pretty.
Yeah.
Like what you've played there. There's a lot of skill in the studio. But I was very bored listening to this.
It's the guts of an hour, 56 or 7 minutes or something.
It really is. And there isn't much variation to the songs or to her vocals. And I mean, like, apparently there is a theme to it. Hannah, H-A-N-A, is the Japanese word for blossom. And it's been inspired by her wanderlust. She spent a lot of time in Japan post-pandemic.
Post-lockdown,
and yet I don't get much of a sense of Japan from this album.
Seemingly she wrote some of it about planning to go to Japan because the trip was delayed.
Okay, well, A Thousand Orchids. Will I do A Thousand Orchids or will I do a bit of Lost in Sunshine, John?
Toss a coin. Well, that's a Thousand Orchids.
A Thousand Orchids, right, okay. I'm listening to that as all three of us are in studio and sing. It's quite pleasant. And again, the lovely singing. It's very hard to dislike it. So why are we kind of not jumping up and down with delight about this album, Gemma?
Probably because I'm not able to get it out of my head and I don't want it living there.
For me, it's the opposite. It's not in my head at all. It floated by, like, I was listening to it in headphones. I got distracted yesterday and I forgot that I was listening to music. And then I suddenly registered, hold on. It's a bit like in a lift, you're not aware of Muzak and suddenly it's there, which is really harsh. I've interviewed this woman as well. She's a great interviewee.
She's fabulous, fun. And the lockdown music was lifted so many times.
And do you know
spheres.
What? Unlike Gemma, I quite like the Groove Jet song and all the rest of it. I quite like that Murder on the Dance Floor. But I just wish there was one or two Murder on the Dance Floor moments here.
I'm sure she would love another Murder on the Dance Floor.
I'm sure she would.
Stars from you, John.
Two.
I think you're not as... Are you in the same... Are you, are
I
you
know,
in
we're in the same two boat here.
Yeah, but for different reasons, I'm guessing, Gemma. You're a little bit... You want it out. You want it thrown out of the boat.
I want it out. I want to turn up the noise on Foo Fighters and get back there.
All right. Those are our three albums for this Friday evening. Sophie Ellis-Bextor, Hannah, an old Gallagher's High Flying Birds, Council Skies and Foo Fighters. But here we are, Sophie Ellis-Bextor, her album Hannah. And our two reviewers this evening, Gemma Tipton and John Marr.